we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both formerly with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right. A very full plate of items to cover, starting out with some good news.
Some good election news from the elections we had the week before this last. In District 1 in West Seattle, Lisa Herbold has pulled ahead in the vote count by about 27 votes as of the last ballot drop.
Yeah, that being yesterday, late afternoon. Mm-hmm. And she'd been closing the gap fairly steadily all week long. But at this point, with what I think about 3,000 votes left to count in mm-hmm. that district, it's looking pretty good for her. The question at this point, since the ballots have been trending in her favor throughout the post-election recounts, is whether she can pull ahead enough to avoid a recount. There's likely going to be a recount there. The other race that is still somewhat close is in District 2 in South Seattle, where Bruce Harrell, the incumbent, is hanging on to a 367-vote lead over Tammy Morales. Now, that has closed from about 1,000 on election night and also has crept steadily closer during the course of the week. But at this point, with, less than about 3,000 votes left to count in that district as well, she probably cannot make up the difference, but it's going to be close enough for a recount that in turn gives Morales' campaign, which has been actively recruiting people to help with this, more time to chase ballots and try and find contested ballots, people for example, forgot to sign their ballots so they weren't counted. But because the intent is clear, if it can be contested, that ballot could be counted. And this is something that campaigns do in close elections to try and round up additional votes, especially if they have more of a surge in the last weeks of the campaign, as is true for both Herbold and Morales.
Yeah. And in some of the other races, Michael Maddox this week conceded to Rob Johnson with an unbridgeable gap of more than 700 votes between them. But I just want to point out again, in that race, Johnson outspent Maddox by about 3-1. So it's pretty amazing that Michael Maddox came that close to Johnson's vote count. And it really says something good, I think, for these district elections.
Yeah, and you know, the whole mainstream media narrative of the election, particularly immediately after the election night, but it's continued throughout the last week and a half, has been, well, this was a resounding endorsement for Mayor Murray's agenda, for the urbanist agenda of density, and they didn't use this language, but corporate welfare for real estate and developers. But that's really not the case, particularly if Herbold wins, and especially if Morales can somehow pull it out as well, which would give a progressive majority on city council. There's significantly more constraints going forward on Murray and the slate of candidates that he ran and that his consultant Christian Sinderman ran. Sinderman had candidates in 8 of the 9 district council races. Really, except for the one race, Sally Bagshaw, where there wasn't seriously contested, all of the opponents in those races ran on housing and affordability platforms, and almost all of them got at least 40%, even though they were badly outspent in most cases. And that is something we have not seen before, where the coronation of incumbents was a routine matter in city council, and it usually was 60, 70, 80% of the vote. That is not what happened this time. And in several of these races, the progressive actually won. So we're going to see a much more ideologically diverse city council going forward.
Yeah, we have Sawant winning handily in District 3, Juarez handily in District 5, O'Brien returning to the council in District 6. And if Lisa Herbold wins, that's four progressives there. And, you know, there are a couple of other new candidates that may side with them on some of the issues. Rob Johnson, for example, may side with them on transportation issues. We don't know.
Yeah, and same for Lorena Gonzalez.
And Lorena Gonzalez could also side for them on some issues.
And again, if Morales pulls ahead of Harrell somehow, that's a fifth vote, which is what you need mm-hmm. for a majority on city council. That's a fifth progressive vote consistently on a lot of issues.
So overall, some very good news coming out of these elections this year.
All right. Moving on, let's move to our sports news for the week.
How about those Seahawks?
Yeah, no. So a New Mexico company, you probably saw the headlines in the Seattle Times this week. A New Mexico real estate investment company, MT Phoenix, made an offer to Mayor Murray to renovate Key Arena for an NBA and NHL team combination. MT Phoenix said that they'd be willing to pay all of the $285 million cost. Now, where they came up with this cost is back in June, an architectural firm, a big architectural firm, AECOM, ACOM, finished a study for the city of Seattle that concluded that Key Arena could be made NBA and NHL compliant for about $285 million. In other words, it is not too small, as most developers and pro sports fans thought. But, of course, Mayor McGinn oversaw the city's approval of a memorandum of understanding with hedge fund manager Chris Hansen to build a $490 million arena in SoTo. The city and King County would, of course, have to put up about $200 million of that cost in bonds. But it has an NBA first provision. The arena could only go forward if Seattle manages to secure an NBA team first.
And that memorandum of understanding also expires next year.
Yeah, it expires at the end of 2017. Murray has said that he thinks the memorandum of understanding will probably expire before Seattle even has a chance to get an NBA team. So, of course, the question then is, why is Murray refusing to respond to MT Phoenix's offer? Because MT Phoenix, I think, forwarded the Key Arena architectural report to Victor Coleman, who is the L.A. Real estate magnate who's been pursuing an NHL team to partner with Chris Hansen's pursuit of an NBA team. And I think that's made everybody who oversaw the MOU a little bit mad that MT Phoenix is doing an end run around the deal that's currently in place. Complicating things, council member Tim Burgess appears to be backing MT Phoenix's bid, which makes sense. I mean, if they can put up 100% of the cost to renovate Key Arena, doesn't that make more sense than the city and county having to pitch in $200 million in bonds?
Yeah, although there's two significant differences between this proposal and the Chris Hansen proposal. One is that the Hansen proposal would be a cornerstone for additional redevelopment of the SoTo area, and there's a lot of residential units that have been proposed for down there.
Yes.
Over the next 10 years. So from a real estate standpoint, the Hansen proposal is much more exciting. And then
it really looks towards what they've called a stadium district, where people could live and spend their time watching sports when they're not going to work.
Yeah, and brew pubs and all the rest of it.
All that good
stuff. And the other piece of it is that one of the main differentials in the cost between the two proposals is the amenities that go into corporate suites and some of the things that average sports fans would have no access to. And that is something that the powers that be are probably more concerned about than the average taxpayer.
And that would be built into a new stadium down in SoTo, whereas Key Arena, that's not so easy to put into a renovated space that doesn't have all of the room for that.
Yeah, and when you hear people say, well, Key Arena doesn't have room for an NBA or NHL team, primarily that's what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Is the state-of-the-art arenas that the NBA and NHL prefer have those kind of amenities and are very helpful for the professional sports leagues, corporate partners.
Yeah, in other words, a renovated Key Arena would be, I don't know, probably a little too working class for the new and modern NBA NHL.
Oh. All right, moving on. City budget fight this week.
Yeah, a city budget fight over whether to fund or not to fund more homeless shelters. The mayor just announced a state of emergency in the city just a week or two ago over the dramatic increase in the number of homeless on Seattle's streets. About 10,000 on any given night are homeless in King County, most of those in Seattle. But, of course, he turned around and said he doesn't want the city council to spend emergency money out of the city's rainy day fund on more homeless shelters, even though the cold, wet weather has already set in and it's going to be winter here very soon. This week, council member Nick Licata proposed diverting the $2.3 million that would be required by ordinance to go into Seattle's rainy day fund. There's a requirement that 0.5% of the budget be set aside and put into the rainy day fund every year. Mayor Murray had proposed that $2.3 million go into the fund this year. But, you know, the rainy day fund is already at the highest it's been in a long time. Adding that $2.3 million would put it at a record high of about $47, $48 million. So why not spend that $2.3 million on a current dramatic need, especially since the mayor, under pressure, I should say, admitted that there's an emergency in terms of the homeless here in Seattle.
Yeah, and Licata and Councilmember Shama Sawant have proposed a number of social justice-oriented amendments to the city budget. Those amendments will be voted on at 10 o'clock on Monday morning in city council chambers, and hopefully people can turn out for that.
Yeah. Now, Mayor Murray has said that he's already put money forward for homeless services in his budget, and that's true, but most of the money will go for initiatives that help people get out of homelessness and into permanent housing. And that's great. But, you know, that presupposes that there's enough affordable permanent housing available to house the 10,000 people who are homeless.
And
there just is not.
Yeah. And it also has been the focus of the 4,683-year plan to end homelessness, which has been operating for 11 years now, with the sort of bureaucratic mindset that we don't really need shelters. What we need is to get people into transitional and then permanent housing. And that approach and the singular focus on that approach clearly has not worked.
Yeah. And, you know, Licata and all of the other homeless advocates and homeless service agencies and volunteers in the city of Seattle, they recognize that and they admit that that's true. But again, they also recognize that there's a lack of affordable housing for low-income folks here in the city of Seattle. And that the best way you can connect homeless people to the services they need, whether it's drug counseling, whether it's getting credit established, whatever, is to get them into some kind of a shelter where homeless advocates can actually have contact with them.
Yeah, there can be case managers there. There can be resources made available, and it's a level of stability and physical safety. It is one of the hidden aspects of this this emergency is the number of people who are homeless on the streets who are victims of violence and violent crime. It is simply not safe, physically safe, for people sleeping on the streets. And this is something that makes it very, very difficult to get established if you're living in fear and having to traipse around all your belongings all the time.
Or you're living out of your car.
Yeah.
I mean, there there has to be some kind of transitional housing or some kind of let's get people out of their tents. Let's get people out of their sleeping bags and stop them from sleeping in doorways and under awnings and so forth. Get them someplace where they can feel safe, where they can feel they have roots, however small, where they can have an address and a phone number where people can contact them. They can get work, they can get counseling or whatever. And the way to do that is to provide them adequate shelter space. And currently, 10,000 people on the streets, Mayor Murray has proposed creating 100 new shelter beds. There's a big gap in the numbers there. And that's what that Licata is proposing that $2.3 million go for, is to close that gap.
Yeah, and then
so go to the city council meeting on Monday.
Absolutely.
And speak up about
Monday morning, 10 o'clock. And if you can't get there, I'll let your district and city council members know how you feel. Mm-hmm. And then the other piece of this is that this is why homeless encampments are so important too, is because they give a sense of community and safety for people who are living in the streets because of inadequate shelter space. That it does give a place for them to go each day and some sort of roots, and this is really the crux of the argument that homeless encampment advocates make. Also, is that it's way better than people living singly or moving around in groups of half a dozen or so, and just finding space where they can to sleep each night.
Yeah. In the meantime, the mayor's office held a meeting this week with homeless advocates, supposedly to discuss the mayor's plan to address the emergency, which, of course, doesn't involve additional money, as we found out. It appears that what it does involve is meeting with homeless advocates to get them on board when the city decides to ramp up doing homeless encampment sweeps again. Now, that takes us back to the bad old days under previous mayors, where particularly Mayor Nichols, where the city's policy was to break up homeless encampments, sweep through, push people out, grab their belongings, and throw them away, essentially, making the crisis even worse.
Yeah, and what we're seeing with this in particular is objections from some neighborhood groups to homeless encampments. There's been a big controversy in Ballard, for example, and some mm-hmm. others around the city where people object to people in cars or people in tents setting up shop somewhere near where they are. And unfortunately, when you have 10,000 people in the streets, that's going to happen.
Yeah, apparently Mayor Murray's idea of potential future sweeps is to make them kinder and gentler by including not just city officials and police pushing them out of tents and out of the places where people are currently encamped or sleeping, but to include a couple of service providers on hand to evaluate homeless people and send them to places where they can get city services. But again, as homeless advocates have pointed out, there just are not enough shelter beds to send these people to.
Yeah. And not surprisingly, homeless advocates are not thrilled about the idea of being made complicit in this in this sort of approach. But a lot of them are dependent on city funding. So I'm sure Murray can find partners for that, but they're going to be very reluctant partners.
Yeah, and of course, when confronted by the media this week, the mayor's office backpedaled and said, oh, no, we're not ramping up any homeless encampment sweeps. We're just trying to see if we can find service providers who would help in case, I don't know, in the future they want to do homeless encampment sweeps.
We're not going to do sweeps. We're just going to push them out. It's totally different.
Yeah, we're just thinking about it.
All right. Moving on to national and student protests at the University of Missouri.
Yeah, actually at universities around the country, but they've been very strong at the University of Missouri. I think folks will remember that Ferguson, the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, happened in Missouri. And there were some, and really you can look at Ferguson as the place where the Black Lives Matter movement really ramped up and got started. There were some veterans of those protests in Ferguson, Missouri, who are also students at the University of Missouri. And apparently at the University of Missouri, students of color have been subjected to harassment for some time there. And those activists from the Ferguson protests decided they were not going to take that harassment this year.
And almost no meaningful response from university administration.
From the university administration. So after weeks of protests by students, the University of Missouri president, Timothy Wolf, and Chancellor R. Bowen Lofton stepped down.
Yeah, and the catalyst for that was the 30 black players on the University of Missouri's football team, which, as with the University of Washington and many other universities, that is the big cash cow that brings in alumni donations. The football team drives the campus. So if you have football players who are essentially not getting paid except for their scholarships, but bring in enormous amounts of money through their labors, and that's a whole other set of issues, when they are suddenly saying, we're not going to play, that gets things moving. And within 2 days of that announcement, and their coach, to his credit, backed them up as well. And then the news broke yesterday that he's actually stepping down. He was planning to step down earlier, but because of a cancer diagnosis, so he had nothing to lose. So he confronted his own school's administration, which really raised people's eyebrows, backed up his players, and 2 days later, the university president was gone.
Yeah, and really it was the alumni looking at that saying, what if our football team doesn't play Brigham Young University, that means we lose out $1 million right there in penalties and possibly more financial penalties as well as the season goes on. And so the alumni and the board stepped forward and said to the president, what are you going to do about this? And he was forced to step down.
Yeah, and longer term, if they ever wanted to recruit African-American football players again to the University of Missouri, they had to do something.
So. Yeah, so in addition to hiring a diversity officer for the whole University of Missouri school system and providing training for students, staff, and faculty, the university system hired Michael Middleton, who's a former law professor and a deputy chancellor, as the new interim president. Middleton, who's also an African-American man and is coming out of retirement, was a former student at the University of Missouri in the 1960s, and he recalled fighting on some of these same issues when he was a student. Now, he agreed that today's students are literally fighting the same battles, not just in terms of racist comments and slights, but also in terms of a lack of acknowledgement of minority culture and minority history within the academia and in terms of the academic curriculum. He told reporters that, quote, that while he served as deputy chancellor, quote, it was extremely difficult, if not impossible, to get the institution to devote the kinds of resources necessary to have a significant impact on this problem. So, of course, his work won't be easy, but at least he's the guy in charge now, and maybe there will be some changes.
Yeah, and as Maria mentioned, there have been similar protests now in this past week in campuses across the country. And
Yale,
this is a
Smith
problem.
College.
Yeah, this is a problem that is rampant in academia, including at the University of Washington, where people who have been part of that community over the years. We're going to be hearing more about it, I'm sure.
Oh yeah.
All right. Moving on, U.S. Appeals Court ruling on immigration.
Yeah, a 3-judge panel of the conservative U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans blocked the implementation of Obama's executive order to provide work permits to 5 million immigrants whose children are U.S. citizens. This ruling, of course, was widely expected because that's a conservative appeals court. But the court itself took a long time issuing that ruling. In fact, too much time, really. It means that they delayed long enough to make it really hard for the Supreme Court to hear and rule on this. Generally, the Supreme Court doesn't fast-track cases, but even if they fast-tracked this case and heard it, they wouldn't rule on it probably until next spring at the earliest. That would give the program only a few months to go into effect and be working before a new president comes into office, a new president who could overturn and reverse Obama's executive order. So interesting news on that front. And, of course, looking like that plan may not have a chance to even go into effect.
All right. Also this week, the minimum wage in New York.
Yeah, Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York announced that he will raise the minimum wage for New York state employees to $15 an hour by the end of 2018. That's inside the city of New York. For employees that live outside the city of New York, it'll be $15 an hour by the year 2021. He used his executive authority to give a gradual pay increase to about 6.5% of the state's public employees, but that's a total of about 10,000 workers. And while the increase is very gradual and not a dramatic one and only represents about 0.1% of the state's budget, it's going to make a difference for those 10,000 workers who were formerly making as low as $8.75 an hour. It could also put some pressure on large employers in the state of New York, and it certainly sets a precedent for other governors around the United States.
Yeah, and what's interesting about this is that Cuomo has a reputation. He's much more conservative than his father was as a New York governor, and very much a creature of Wall Street, a creature of the business community. And to have somebody with that kind of backing take this kind of step really underscores that minimum wage increases are not an anti-business strategy, that the smart business people recognize that this is something that promotes a more vibrant economy.
Smart business people, but not the Republican Party. I think Donald Trump in the latest debate said, "Oh, we can't raise the minimum wage because wages are too high in America." And
then every single one of the candidates,
yes,
said,
and they all agreed.
Yeah,
and then of course they turned around later and were talking about immigration. I think Trump was the one who said, "Well, immigrants come into America and they drive wages down." And you have to you have to look at that and say, "Dude, you can't have it both ways. You can't say in one breath that wages are too high in America and then turn around and say in the next breath, because we allow immigrants into the country and we don't prosecute them and throw them back out immediately, that wages are too low."
Yeah, and a couple things about that. Number one, it's not the immigrants who are setting the wages.
No, it is not.
And beyond that, the coverage of the Republican debate, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, but it's all about, well, this was a more substantive debate. Well, yeah, if you mean by that. Rather than calling each other names, they were each discussing how many horns are on a unicorn. Yes, it was more substantive. It was not more reality based, however.
Yeah.
All right. Leaves us a little bit of time to talk about what happened in Paris yesterday.
Yeah, the attacks in Paris. I didn't actually look at the news this morning, but before I went to bed last night, there were well over 100 dead and 200 wounded.
It's at least 150 confirmed dead now.
Yeah, and there were seven suicide bombers, multiple coordinated attacks around Paris by suicide bombers and mass shooters, particularly a mass shooting in a nightclub at a large concert there. I was watching this news as it unfolded, and my first response was, well, Paris is not that far from Turkey and the civil war in Syria. And as anyone knows who's been covering wars for a long period of time, and even as defense analysts know, that when you drop a lot of weapons into a region like the U.S. and its allies are dropping into Turkey right now, some of the weapons will flow in the direction you want them to, which is across the border into Syria to fight ISIL and the Syrian government. And some of those weapons are going to get diverted and flow in the opposite direction into Europe. And this is an illustration of what can happen when that happens.
Yeah, the fear with this, of course, and you know, even going back to the days of the Mujahideen fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan, the jihadist strategy has been to perpetrate outrages against civilians in the expectation that the West will overreact, perpetrate even greater outrages in the Muslim world, and that helps them win hearts and minds and grow in power. That's been a winning strategy, certainly in post 9/11 it was as well, and that's the fear here, is that the West is looking in the early hours of the response to this like it's going to take the bait again. The president of France, who's been the one major Western power other than the United States, has been most active in dropping bombs in Syria, promising a pitiless war. You have 6 million Muslim people in France, and they're going to, I'm sure, experience significant blowback. You have the Paris climate talks coming up in a couple of weeks, and this is going to make it much more difficult for the protesters there coming from all over the world to operate freely. There are a number of implications of this going forward, and the policy of the United States as well, that people who want more weapons and more war in the Middle East are going to use this and run with it.
As an excuse to continue and widen the conflict, when in fact it is the conflict itself that is the root cause of this. I mean, there will always be people who want to attack the status quo wherever you go. It's providing them the weapons, the excuse, and making them angry enough to actually act on that and continuing the conflict, spreading the conflict, widening it, will make things even worse.
Yeah, and giving them enough of a rationale that they feel that the acts that they perpetrate can have some appeal and some sympathy among their base of supporters.
Yes.
Events.
Several coming up later today. You'll be hearing about some of that and certainly how a lot of different protest movements have evolved out of the Occupy movement. Coming up at 3 o'clock at Elliott Bay Books and on Capitol Hill with Arun Gupta, who you heard at 7:30. And I'm going to butcher his last name here, Gudo Wartofsky. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Anyway, that's 3 o'clock at Elliott Bay Books today if you want to get in out of the rain and hear a good talk. Monday, as we mentioned, 10 o'clock in the morning, City Council voting on social service budget amendments being put forward by particularly by council members Licata and Sawant. And they certainly are hoping to have a large turnout of supporters there for that. And if you can't get down to City Hall on Monday morning, let your council members know how you feel about those, and I believe the list of proposed amendments is on both websites of council members Licata and Sawant. And then on Wednesday, the 18th of November, a couple of really good and experienced speakers coming to town. Joe Cirincione, who is a longtime anti-nuclear weapons and nuclear program analyst, and the Trini Parsi, who is one of the leading advocates in the country for better relations between the United States and Iran. They'll be speaking jointly on the policy and politics of the Iran nuclear agreement. That's at Town Hall, $5 as usual, at 8th and Seneca in downtown Seattle.
And then I have a couple of additional events on Sunday, on November 15th. There's a film screening and discussion. The film is Resistencia, the Fight for the Aguan Valley, about resistance to the 2009 coup in Honduras. It has a visiting panel. A couple of members of the panel are from Honduras, and of course the filmmaker will be there. That's at the Grand Illusion at 50th and University Way from 7 to 9 p.m., and that's sponsored by the Community Alliance for Global Justice. On Thursday is a community workshop with Idle No More, the history of colonization through a Native American perspective, and it will be incorporating some traditional teachings. That's at the downtown Seattle Public Library at 1000 4th Avenue from 6 to 8 p.m. on Thursday.
All right.